it and read it in its every form and genre.
Fadr International Poetry Festival was launched in 2006 as a platform for Persian poets from Iran and other Persian-speaking countries to get together for the elevation of Persian poetry. However, the literary event has grown to encompass non-Persian poets who are interested in Iranian literature.
Poetry holds a special position among Iranians, and you can rarely find an Iranian family that doesn't have a poetry book in their bookshelves. Now, aside from acknowledging Persian literary figures and poets, Fadr Festival seeks to preserve this long-standing culture and introduce it to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In United States, a television news anchor in Pensacola, Florida, challenged Representative Matt Gaetz on Friday, 4th of March, over his claims that former President Donald Trump won the 2020 presidential election. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek magazine journalist Andrew Stanton. The piece is titled Matt Gaetz challenged by TV anchor after saying Trump won 2020 election. Stay with us for more of Andrew Stanton's article. In the U.S., a television news anchor in Pensacola, Florida, challenged Representative Matt Gaetz on Friday, 4th of March, over his claims that former President Donald Trump won the 2020 presidential election. Representative Matt Gaetz, a Florida Republican, has been among the GOP figures who promoted the unproven claims that President Joe Biden only won in 2020 due to widespread voter fraud. I believe that Donald Trump won the 2020 election, he said on local news station WEAR-TV, after anchor Bob Sulawski asked if he still buys into the theory of a stolen election. Bob Sulawski responded, "You can't say that without saying that there was a gigantic conspiracy across this country and supervisor of election officers everywhere to make this happen. And we haven't still seen any evidence that proves that." The confrontation came during a discussion about former Attorney General William Barr's remarks dismissing efforts that were made to change the election results. The objection process has become almost commonplace. It certainly has with Republicans when they get elected, the representative said, who has long voiced skepticism that Joe Biden rightfully won the election. On the presidential level, there have only been three instances of Electoral College objections: in 1969, in 2005, and in 2021. All were rejected by Congress. In October of last year, Representative Jamie Raskin, a Maryland Democrat, pressed Matt Gaetz on whether or not he accepts the results of the 2020 presidential election. "I think that our election was uniquely polluted by these indiscriminate mail-in ballots," Matt Gaetz responded at the time. He added, "I think this was the first time in America's history where the mailbox beat the ballot box." Some Republicans sought to overturn the 2020 presidential election results by citing widespread voter fraud, even though no significant evidence has been provided to back up those claims. On 6 January 2021, congressional Republicans challenged the Electoral College certification, while Capitol rioters engaged in a violent protest to pressure Congress to overturn the election results. In the months following the election, Republicans in several states, including Arizona and Wisconsin, pushed for audits of the election, but every audit upheld the results. Representative Matt Gaetz, meanwhile, has continued to ally himself with Donald Trump, saying that they have discussed the possibility of the former president becoming the next Speaker of the House of Representatives if Republicans retake a majority in Congress. "I told him, you don't even have to be Speaker for the whole day," he said, while appearing on Sebastian Gorka's American First. "You could do it for like 3 or 4 hours, give us a great speech, make a few structural reforms to the institution, and then you could resign, and we could have another election for Speaker." Newsweek has reached out to Matt Gaetz's office for comment on Saturday morning, but has received no response. Meanwhile, Representative Matt Gaetz has said he believes one of the goals of the January 6th House Select Committee is to block former President Donald Trump from running for president in 2024 by disqualifying him as a candidate. Representative Madison Cawthorn's candidacy for re-election is being challenged in North Carolina because of his alleged stoking of violence on 6th of January and allegedly aiding Capitol rioters. Madison Cawthorn's challengers are invoking the disqualification clause of the Constitution, and Matt Gaetz believes the same tactic will be used against former President Donald Trump. Disqualifying potential candidates is the newest and most dangerous iteration of cancel culture, Matt Gaetz said on Thursday. "I believe the January 6th committee is going to try to do it regarding Donald Trump." The 14th Amendment, also known as a disqualification clause, was ratified after the Civil War with the intention of preventing officials who supported insurrection from holding office in the future. North Carolina voters who are challenging Madison Cawthorn's candidacy cite comments he made in a speech shortly before the 6th of January Capitol riot and said the violence on that day amounted to an insurrection. Claiming to be fighting a battle for our Constitution, Madison Cawthorn has engaged in blatant acts of insurrection, John Wallace, a lawyer who filed the lawsuit, argued. John Wallace added, "He must be held accountable for his actions, which have threatened our democracy. Wisely, the Constitution provides a remedy for our protection." Madison Cawthorn filed a federal lawsuit over the challenge of his re-election campaign, calling it unconstitutional. In a statement, he said he has never and would never engage in an insurrection against the United States and called the challenge to his candidacy a weapon by liberal Democrats intended to defeat our democracy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, the people, and also the region as a whole. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the Pakistani Prime Minister's visit to Moscow at the height of the Ukraine crisis points to Islamabad's drift towards Russia. And we shall also look at what India's abstention from a UN Security Council resolution against Russia means to its relations with the US.
Hours before Russian President Vladimir Putin green-lighted a military operation in Ukraine on February 24th, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan touched down in Moscow. The first visit to Russia by Pakistani Premier in 23 years was overshadowed by Russia's military intervention in a former Soviet republic. Although the visiting official steered clear of making any inflammatory statements, the timing of the visit amid heightened tensions between Moscow and the West over Ukraine showed which way Islamabad's foreign policy is drifting.
Pakistan's cricketer-turned-premier Imran Khan chose to meet Russian leader Vladimir Putin hours after the Kremlin recognized the two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine as independent, and hours before Russian troops made a foray into the neighboring country. What a time to come, so much excitement, Prime Minister Khan was heard saying after stepping off his chartered plane to a red carpet reception in Moscow. Khan's historic visit, while representing a key milestone in Pakistan-Russia relations, demonstrated Islamabad's growing desire to align with American rivals Moscow and Beijing after reluctantly being in the shadow of Washington for years. In an interview with Russia television before the visit, Khan expressed concern over the Ukraine crisis and potential sanctions on Moscow. After the visit, a Pakistani government statement noted with regret developments in Ukraine and said it hoped diplomacy could avert a military conflict. A statement by the Russian government said the two sides discussed bilateral cooperation and regional developments. In Washington, U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the Biden administration had communicated its position to Islamabad on what it called Russia's renewed invasion of Ukraine, while taking strong umbrage to Khan's Moscow trip amid heightened tensions over Ukraine.
The growing proximity between Islamabad and Moscow is causing jitters in Washington, which has for years used its political and financial clout to keep the South Asian country subservient to it. Prime Minister Khan's visit to Moscow at the height of the Ukraine crisis and the refusal to outrightly condemn Russia's military intervention has to be seen in the context of the realignment of power centers and the fall of American hegemony. Pakistan, which has partnered with the U.S. in the Cold War against the Soviet Union, has now joined the revival camp.
Prime Minister Khan's visit to Moscow was planned well before the U.S.-led NATO military alliance stoked the flames of war between Moscow and Kyiv. The visit was aimed at bolstering bilateral ties, according to Pakistani officials. Experts see Islamabad's outreach to Moscow as part of efforts to offset worsening ties with the US and to outmaneuver its arch foe, New Delhi. While the timing of the visit has fueled intense debate, the main objective was to address Pakistan's acute energy crisis and to finalize a long-delayed multi-billion-dollar gas pipeline deal with Moscow. The two sides also discussed ways to boost bilateral trade. In 2020, the volume of their trade stood at $790 million, marking a jump of 46% from the previous year. However, in 2021, it dropped to $697 million, as per official data.
People are facing a lot of difficulties. You can see the lines. You can see the people stand 3 hours, 4 hours in the line, and they cannot do any damn thing.
The two sides also discussed the modernization of the Karachi metallurgical plant and reconstruction of Pakistan's energy and railway systems in collaboration with Russian companies. And much to the chagrin of India, Khan also raised the issue of Kashmir in his talks with Putin, decrying the Indian government's excesses in the disputed Himalayan region. Notably, India had in the past banked on Soviet support and its veto power in the Security Council in its dispute over Kashmir with Pakistan.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Anwar Rizvi, South Asia analyst, joining us from London. First of all, welcome to the programme, Mr. Rizvi. Now, Prime Minister Khan's visit to Moscow, the first by a Pakistani premier in 23 years, came hours before Kremlin ordered a military operation in Ukraine. Now, could we say this timing was just a mere coincidence?
Thank you for inviting me to the show, Amin, and a very good evening from London. With regards to the timing of the visit itself, as you very well know, these things are discussed months in advance. There's a lot of back and forth between diplomatic circles before a visit like this takes place. With regards to the war between Russia and Ukraine, obviously Imran Khan would not have known in advance that the invasion was going to come within hours of his visit. And it would have been quite discourteous of him to actually cancel the visit at the last minute. He's going to visit a country like Russia, which is hugely important. So he was not just going to cancel it randomly just because there was a possibility of a war. I'm not going to criticize him for the timing of the visit. I think he really had to go through with the visit because it had been arranged quite a long time in advance. So no criticism with regards to the actual timing of it.
Mr. Rizvi, although Imran Khan refrained from taking sides and urged the warring sides to find a diplomatic way out of the crisis, many say the visit is indicative of Islamabad's gradual drift towards Kremlin. Now, what's your take on this?
I'm not entirely sure whether it's a drift towards Kremlin. I think what Imran Khan and what Pakistan need is more allies who are closer to Pakistani interests than perhaps the West. And in that regard, I guess he would like to have closer ties with Russia. I think this is a process that's going to take a very long time. I don't think one visit by Imran Khan is going to do anything. Russia has got many other issues to look at right now. Obviously, it is at war with Ukraine. That is the biggest issue for that country. And the repercussions of that war, once the war, hopefully, is going to be over soon. We don't want any more loss of life there. And once that war is over, there'll be many other issues for Russia to deal with. So I think Imran Khan's visit is not going to make huge progress in that respect in the near to medium-term future. Long term, there is a possibility that once things settle down, that this could develop into a good partnership between the two countries.
Mr. Rizvi, Pakistan relations with Moscow and Beijing have strengthened in recent years, much to the chagrin of Washington. Do you think Islamabad has come out of the U.S. shadow for good?
No, not at all. You have got to look at it from purely, first of all, from an economic perspective. The European Union and the U.S. are still Pakistan's largest trading partners. More than half of Pakistan exports are the European Union and the United States. And Pakistan has actually got a balanced trade surplus. So Pakistan actually earns more money that it spends on the import and export from these two blocks. So the economic ties are still very, very strong. And to start building a closer relations with Russia. Only 0.07% of Pakistan's export is to Russia. So you need to put these things into perspective. But the real point here is that why does Pakistan need to make themselves subservient, regardless of which superpowers it is, whether it's Russia or China or the US or whatever. Once you start making yourself too subservient to one particular superpower, you also make yourself subservient to their strategic needs and their strategic demands. Now, Pakistan itself is a nuclear power with a very large population, quite a skillful population. What Pakistan really needs to do in the medium term and in the long term is to start building relationships with its immediate neighbors, which is Iran and India. Now, I know that with India, there is the issue of Kashmir and there are other political issues, but you still need to keep that channel open. India is one of the largest economies in the world right now. It's right on Pakistan's doorstep. Iran, with all its energy resources. So those are the partnerships that Pakistan really needs to start looking at very seriously and very carefully and start developing those relationships and become less subservient to the needs of any superpower in this world. It doesn't matter if it's China, whether it's Russia or whatever. If it wants to build a strategic relationship with Russia in the long term, that there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. But once you make yourself completely dependent, as the case is with Pakistan right now, that it's almost becoming completely dependent for its survival on China, I don't think that's a very healthy thing. I think long term, this could have very negative consequences for Pakistan.
Last but not least, how important is Russia for Pakistan at a time when the South Asian country is grappling with a severe energy crisis? And how do you see the prospects of the long-delayed gas pipeline deal?
Well, again, I'll go back to my previous response. I mean, with regards to the energy crisis, we have got Iran right next door to us. There has been this pipeline coming from Iran for many, many years. Nothing has been done about it. I mean, the reason why no Pakistani government has ever taken the next step forward with regards to pipeline from Iran is because of the sanctions. Now, there are going to be sanctions on Russia. So if you're not taking, if you're not getting your energy needs from Iran because you're so afraid of the sanctions, how are you going to do it with Russia, which is even further away than Iran? Iran is right there on your doorstep. It's going to be far cheaper and easier to get your energy needs from Iran than it would from Russia. So it doesn't make any sense to me, at least in the short to medium term future. That really, if you're not doing any business with Iran right now because you're afraid of the sanctions, how are you going to do business with Russia, which is also going to be under sanctions, perhaps even more severe sanctions than Iran? So that really doesn't make any sense to me. Right now, maybe in the longer term, this could change. But immediately, I think that really is a complete non-starter, as far as I'm concerned.
Mr. Rizvi, thank you for being on the program, and thank you for your time. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Mohammad Faisal, an EU-based diplomatic mediator, says PM Imran Khan has become a globally recognized figure following his visit to Moscow in the middle of the Ukraine crisis. Pakistani political commentator Asfandiar Bitani disagrees with those who think PM Imran Khan shouldn't have visited Moscow at this time, saying Islamabad should prioritize its own interests. Rana Ayyub, a prominent Indian journalist and columnist, says PM Imran Khan's Moscow visit reflects the greatly improved ties between Pakistan and Russia, signaling the development of a new regional axis.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India's decision to abstain from voting on a UN Security Council resolution to condemn Russia's military intervention in Ukraine has not been received well in the US. A Cold War ally of the Soviet Union, New Delhi, has traditionally maintained pro-Russia positions. but it has also been wary of antagonizing Washington, which remains its biggest trade partner. Experts say the refusal to vote against Russia may not necessarily mean endorsement of the military action in Ukraine, but reflects India's dependence on Russia for energy, arms and trade.
Russia's military intervention in Ukraine has split the world into those who deemed it warranted and those who oppose it. There are also countries that have assumed neutrality, refusing to overtly condemn Kremlin's actions while urging the warring sides to exercise restraint.
Over the last days, we have seen a significant movement of Russian military forces into Belarus. This is the biggest Russian deployment there since the Cold War.
India on Friday urged Russia and Ukraine to try diplomacy while turning down the call of the US and its NATO allies to vote against Russia, which would have put their relations spanning over seven decades at risk. While Russia vetoed the UN Security Council resolution, India, UAE and China abstained. The stance earned India lavish praise from Russia, which called it independent and balanced. The Russian embassy in India said Moscow was committed to maintaining dialogue with India on the situation in Ukraine in the spirit of the special and privileged strategic partnership. On Thursday, in his telephone conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi appealed for immediate cessation of violence, saying Russia and NATO can bury the hatchet only through honest and sincere dialogue. The United States, clearly taken aback by India's position on the Ukraine crisis, on Saturday urged New Delhi, a member of the Quad grouping, to use its influence with Russia to protect the rules-based international order.
India has chosen to tread cautiously on the Ukraine crisis, but still has managed to show support for Russia, notwithstanding the US pressure. The two countries have had a time-tested relationship, mainly hinging on defense cooperation and trade ties. India's decision to abstain from voting against Russia in the UN Security Council was also choreographed to avoid its regional isolation at a time when China is already exerting pressure on it through border incursions and tensions with Pakistan and also Taliban-ruled Afghanistan.
India's peculiar position on Russia's military intervention in Ukraine has been a subject of intense debate in intelligentsia circles. Both Ukraine and Russia have been important trade partners for New Delhi, but its relations with Moscow go beyond trade and commerce. As a formidable regional player, India sees strong ties with Russia of huge strategic significance.
India gives top priority to its relations with Russia. In this rapidly changing world, our relations have become more relevant. Our special and privileged strategic partnership has consistently received new energy and direction from the continuous series of 19 summits.
India-Russia bilateral trade stood at $9.4 billion this fiscal year, as against $8.1 billion in the last fiscal. The two regional bulwarks have set a target of $30 billion in bilateral trade by the end of 2025. India is heavily dependent on Russia for oil and gas. State-run Gas Authority of India Limited inked a 20-year deal with Russia's Gazprom in 2018 for 2.5 million tons of liquefied natural gas a year. The two countries also have strong defense ties. Last year, they signed an agreement to extend their military technology cooperation for the next decade. India's acquisition of Russia-made S-400 missile systems has also bolstered their defense ties. However, with the Western countries announcing unprecedented sanctions on Russia, it would be interesting to see how India navigates through them.
The triumph has been one of the most significant deals, partly because there has been a sense in Russia that Indo-Russian relations are sort of drifting. So I think by signing this deal, despite American pressure, India is signaling that it values Russia as a defense partner. And hopefully that will change the narrative in Russia about India and in India about Russia.
India is also careful not to antagonize Russia when it faces hostile neighbors in China and Pakistan, both of whom share close relations with Moscow.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Nandan Onikrishnan, from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Unnikrishnan. Now, the abstention from a UN Security Council resolution to decry Russia's military operation in Ukraine has raised eyebrows in the West. Now, will it affect India's relations with the US?
Well, I think the answer to that is already available. The spokesperson for the White House after the vote said that the United States understands that India has a distinct relationship with Russia and that the United States is okay with that. So as far as India is concerned, there should not be any reason for tensions or wrinkles in their relationship with the United States.
Now, many argue that the refusal to condemn Russia's actions in Ukraine reflect India's growing dependence on Russia for energy, arms and trade. Do you agree?
No. I think those are actually... Firstly, we are not dependent on Russia on energy. Definitely not. There is a certain level of dependence in the defense sector. But the primary reason are not these. The primary reason is that India faces multiple external challenges. And amongst them, the main challenge is from the aggressive rise of China. And India has an issue with China. In fact, in 2020, there was a crisis on the borders. It continues even today. It's not fully resolved. So India's challenges from China, it requires the partnership of both countries, United States and Russia. The United States is India's partner in the Indo-Pacific, but India's challenges in the Eurasian landmass, that is on the continental shelf, it needs Russia to help there too. So therefore, India is going to maintain good relations, strive to maintain good relations with both countries, because they are of, they're India's essential partners. I mean, they're critical to India's interests.
So how important is Russia's friendship for India at a time when its relations with China and Pakistan continue to deteriorate?
Look, Russia is an independent country. Russia will at all points of time pursue its national interest. And as long as it does that without affecting India's strategic interests, I think India is comfortable with that. Russia and India have a fairly, I mean, have a very good relationship. And therefore, if something they do affects India's understanding of its strategic stability, the Indians will definitely discuss it with Russia and take its position after that discussion.
And last but not least, India's acquisition of Russian S-400 missile systems has boosted the traditional ties. Now, do you see defense cooperation as one of the key factors pushing New Delhi closer to Moscow?
You know, one defense system does not become the key point. Apart from the S-400, Russia gives India nuclear submarines. No nation in the world does that. So, you know, it's... There is a level of cooperation. India has developed a certain level of trust, and that continues. The problem that has arisen is that the United States has an adversarial relationship with the Russians, and they have brought into play the sanctions regime. So India's purchase of military systems from Russia are within the ambit of those sanctions. But India is hoping that one of the aims of the United States coming closer with India, apart from China, is also the fact that it wants India to be militarily strong country. And what Russia is doing is, in a sense, strengthening India's military. So India is hoping that the United States will give exemptions to India on this particular score, just as the United States gave an exemption to India's relationship with Iran on the Chabahar port.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Unnikrishnan for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
A senior fellow at Brookings Institution, Tanvi Madan, notes that India's dependence on Russia cannot be dismissed, which somehow justifies its stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. Vaibhav Singh, a New Delhi-based strategic affairs analyst, describes India's response to the crisis in Ukraine as measured and logical. He says Russia is India's ally, while the West has done little to improve its ties with New Delhi. A security analyst and human rights activist, Sonam Mahajan, slams Ukrainian border guards for physically assaulting Indian students stuck at the Poland border, which she links to India's UN Security Council vote.
And that was our episode about Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan's historic Moscow visit and India's refusal to vote against Russia on the Ukraine crisis. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the Supreme Court on Thursday, 3rd of March, shut down efforts by a detainee at Guantanamo Bay to obtain information from two former CIA contractors involved in torturing him, ruling that the inquiry would impermissibly expose state secrets. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Adam Liptak. The piece is titled, CIA Black Sites Are State Secrets, The Supreme Court Rules. US, the Supreme Court on Thursday, 3rd of March, shut down efforts by a detainee at Guantanamo Bay to obtain information from two former CIA contractors involved in torturing him, ruling that the inquiry would impermissibly expose state secrets. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, writing for a badly fractured court, said, "The main question was whether the information sought by the detainee, known as Abu Zubaydah, would confirm the location of a CIA black site, which is widely known to have been in Poland." The Supreme Court justices split 6-3 on the question of whether the case could proceed. In dissent, Justice Neil Gorsuch, joined by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, said the government sought to avoid further embarrassment for past misdeeds. "The facts are hard to face," he wrote. "We know already that our government treated Abu Zubaydah brutally. More than 80 waterboarding sessions, hundreds of hours of live burial, and what it calls rectal rehydration. Further evidence along the same lines may lie in government's vaults. But as embarrassing as these facts may be, there is no state secret here. This court's duty is to the rule of law and the search for truth." Justice Gorsuch wrote. He added, "We should not let shame obscure our vision." Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, on the other hand, insisted that the question at issue was a limited one. "Obviously, the court condones neither terrorism nor torture," he wrote. "But in this case, we are required to decide only a narrow evidentiary dispute." He conceded that the location of the black site had been acknowledged by an international tribunal and a former president of Poland. But he wrote, that official confirmation of the location of the torture by the United States government was a different matter. It stands to reason that a former CIA insider's confirmation of confidential cooperation between the CIA and a foreign intelligence service could damage the CIA's clandestine relationships with foreign authorities, he wrote. Confirmation by such an insider is different in kind from speculation in the press or even by foreign courts of law, because it leaves virtually no doubt as to the veracity of the information that has been confirmed. Abu Zubaydah sought to subpoena the contractors, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, in connection with a Polish criminal investigation. The inquiry was prompted by a determination by the European Court of Human Rights that he had been tortured in 2002 and 2003 at secret sites operated by the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, including one site in Poland. When the case United States v. Hussein, No. 20827, was argued in October, David F. Klein, a lawyer for Abu Zubaydah, said he was not seeking testimony about the location of the black site. I'm not planning to ask, did it happen in Poland, he said. Rather, David Klein said, he sought information about his client's treatment. What happened inside Abu Zubaydah's cell between December of 2002 and September of 2003, he asked, giving the dates during which his client was understood to be held in Poland. How was Abu Zubaydah fed? What was his medical condition? What was his cell like? And yes, was he tortured? Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer wrote, questions like those would inevitably tend to confirm or deny whether the CIA operated a detention site located in Poland. In a concurring opinion endorsing Justice Breyer's bottom line, but not his reasoning, Justice Clarence Thomas, joined by Justice Samuel Alito, wrote that the executive branch was entitled to even more deference than the majority had given it. Justice Elena Kagan, in a partial dissent in the case, said she agreed that the location of the black site must be protected, but said the case could nonetheless proceed. I would allow Abu Zubaydah to amend his request to remove all Poland-specific references, she wrote, so that he can obtain testimony about his detention in whatever country it took place. In his dissent, Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, who had defended the Bush administration's detention policies as a Justice Department official back in 2005 and 2006, said there was no point in barring testimony about the location of the site. We should not be ignorant as judges of what we know to be true as citizens, he wrote. The location of the CIA's detention site has been acknowledged by the former Polish president, investigated by the Council of Europe and proven beyond reasonable doubt to the European Court of Human Rights, he wrote. Doubtless, these disclosures may have done damage to national security interests, but nothing in the record of this case suggests that requiring the government to acknowledge what the world already knows to be true would invite a reasonable danger of additional harm to national security. Abu Zubaydah, whose real name is Zainul Abidin Muhammad Hussein, was captured in Pakistan in March of 2002 and was initially thought to be a high-level member of Al-Qaeda. A 2014 report from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence said the CIA later concluded that Abu Zubaydah was not a member of Al-Qaeda. He was the first prisoner held by the CIA after the 11th of September 2001 attacks to undergo so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, a euphemism for torture, which were based on a list of suggestions drawn up for use on him by Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Jessen, both psychologists. Dr. Mitchell has testified that he and Dr. Jessen, who had experience with an Air Force program that taught pilots how to resist torture, were hired by the CIA to consult on the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah. They were ultimately assigned to carry out the torture techniques on him in the summer of 2002. A federal judge granted the government's motion to block the subpoena, saying that proceeding with discovery would present an unacceptable risk for disclosing state secrets. But a divided three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, California, ruled that it might be possible to segregate information protected by the state secrets privilege, which bans disclosures that could endanger national security, from other materials. The full Ninth Circuit declined to rehear the panel's decision over the dissents of 12 judges who said the ruling was riddled with grave legal errors and posed a serious risk to our national security.
Economic divide.
The Russian military operation in Ukraine has shown the world one thing: anger Russia and it can cost you, because that is what the US-led NATO has done. But with pain inflicted, there's pain received. Hi, I'm Omid Roshandel, filling in for Kaveh Taghvai. In this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at the economic pain that the world will feel, including Russia's economic pain, and how it had pre-planned a scheme to minimize the sanctions blitz on its country. Coming up in today's program, the Russian military operation against Ukraine has brought some of the worst sanctions from a host of countries, including the US, the UK, and the European Union. Russian banks, financial institutions, some of Putin's inner circle, and technology transfer, to name a few. The world economic impact: energy, commodities, and food prices will see a surge in prices, especially in the European Union. Things like wheat, aluminum, and nickel palladium will be affected, putting into jeopardy a world recovery. Russia's plans to soften the sanctions impact. Plans in the works from years ago, from decreasing its dollar reserve currency and switching it to gold, to its own payment system. Will this be enough to shield it from sanctions, especially from the U.S.?
We've cut off Russia's largest bank, a bank that holds more than one-third of Russia's banking assets by itself, cut it off from the U.S. financial system.
The crisis between Russia and Ukraine has reached a critical point.
And today, we're also blocking four more major banks. That means every asset they have in America will be frozen.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defense. And these sanctions will increase Russia's borrowing costs, raise inflation, and gradually erode Russia's industrial base.
These are major sanctions, not only because they are wide-ranging, but because they are not only the United States, but also Europe, the G7 countries, Switzerland, and others have all come together to ally against Russia on a range of issues.
Russia is Europe's main energy supplier. It relies on Russia for much of its energy.
We have to think about the future. Germany will need more gas because domestic production is declining, because we also need more gas-fired power plants.
Oil prices already had surged recently to their highest level since 2014.
The sanctions package that has been announced is very big. Are there more things to come? Yes. We don't know what that looks like. Some of the things that have been held back are sanctions on the oil and gas sector. I think that the West is going to try to continue to hold back on sanctioning the oil and gas sector.
Stock prices dropped after Putin recognized the independence of rebel-held regions of Ukraine.
I guess we're going to see more inflation. And that certainly will have a knock-on effect on the Federal Reserve, on the Federal Reserve policies and central bankers. So we would expect a rise in interest rates.
Well, there's a lot of ways these sanctions are going to affect companies because both Ukraine and Russia are major commodities exporters, metals, wheat, grain, soybeans. So right away, you've already seen there's going to be a spike in prices of certain commodities that are going to become in short supply. It's the old adage of supply and demand.
Sanctions against Russia could also create an environment for close cooperation between countries already under Western sanctions. They include Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and to some extent, China. A closer cooperation between these countries would dent the impact of Western sanctions and ultimately make them futile. China's close ties with Russia is an important factor. Beijing and Russia have signed major energy and industry deals, and China's economic support could help Russia get out of the crisis.
The world economy will not be able to adjust from the impact of this Russian military on Ukraine quickly. Even though much of the social media posts are against Russia, this brings to light the important and deep role that Russia actually plays in the world economy. Joe Biden had this to say 2 days into this crisis. "I spoke with the G7 leaders today, and we are in full agreement. We will limit Russia's ability to be part of the global economy. We will stunt their ability to finance and grow Russia's military. We will impair their ability to compete in a high-tech 21st century economy." Russia has also been building an in-house system since 2014, the last time SWIFT cutoff was threatened, which may mean they are able to temper some of their impact a cutoff would have on its economy. Though it appears most experts still expect the impact will be significant. There has been a lot of discussions around cutting Russia off the SWIFT financial system, but those plans have not happened yet. The in-house system, though, that this person referred to has been in the works for some time. The system is known as SPFS. It is designed to allow financial institutions to communicate between each other, keeping transactions flowing, and it is meant to help reduce the threat of the U.S. government's control through the SWIFT International Payment Network. And then there is the reality that the ones imposing the sanctions have to face, and that is the fact that the effect that they are after may not happen as soon as they would like. Sanctions are a big deal, experts say, but effects could take years. This is what Brian O'Toole has said. He served in the U.S. Department of the Treasury as a senior advisor to the director of the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which administers and enforces trade and economic sanctions. He said it could take quite a while, even years, for the sanctions to hurt the Russian economy. Now, Paul Ingram is joining us from Cambridge. He is with the Cambridge Center for Study of Existential Risk. Paul, it's good to have you with us. Thank you for joining the program. War has broken out, and a full scale of sanctions is in effect. Russia is a key supplier of not only gas and oil, but also raw materials that keep world's factories running. Now, we know that Europe gets 40% of its gas and 25% of its oil from Russia, and oil prices have also skyrocketed. Germany also stopped the Nord Stream 2. How badly will sanctioning Russia affect Europe, its energy needs, and in turn, its economy, in your opinion?
Europe is so heavily dependent on Russian energy imports that it's very difficult to see them putting full sanctions on Russia. I could be wrong, and could wake up tomorrow and there could be full sanctions. But if there were, it would have a huge impact on European economies. And so I think it depends really on Russian actions over the coming hours and days. Are we seeing Russian actions that nibble off bits of Ukraine, that have not been under control of the government for the last few years in any case, and bits of Ukraine that are pretty much majority Russian? This is deeply unacceptable to European countries, and the manner in which the Russians have been doing this has been deeply unacceptable. But it's not the trigger for all-out conflict. And the parallels with 1939 have been deeply misplaced up until now. So if the Russians instead decide that they are indeed intending to invade the whole of Ukraine and occupy it with a major, major invasion, then I think we will see all-out energy sanctions and other sanctions, and this will have a huge impact on European economies. But I suspect that European governments, they've been talking themselves up the last few weeks, and I think it would be difficult for them not to impose these sanctions in the case of an all-out invasion of Ukraine. And they would see this as acceptable damage to their economies with the purpose of once and for all confronting Putin and perhaps trying to trigger some kind of a reversal or even an overthrowing of Putin in the Kremlin. Of course, these are very, very high stakes, and I think as a result, there may well be quite serious impacts on the European and indeed the global economy.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I will get back to you later in the program. I'm now joined by Tobias Baumann. He is a historian and expert in German and French constitutional law, joining us from Berlin. Tobias, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the program. Russia is the world's largest exporter of wheat, and together with Ukraine, it accounts for around a quarter of total global exports of wheat. And the sanctions impact from gas, oil, aluminum, palladium, nickel, and wheat will affect a world still struggling to recover from the pandemic, especially the poor. Now, the question is, how will the world economy suffer from this?
Yes, Russian palladium is necessary for memory chips and auto catalysts, Russian titanium for aircraft construction. So Deutsche Bank has stated today that airlines might lose 10% of their stock value. The supply chains will be even further damaged, and hundreds of German companies may be harmed. And we will also face very high inflation. So, of course, U.S. leads us to an economic chaos in Eurasia, which serves the interests of its fracking industry as well as political purposes, because the intense media campaigns in NATO countries have permitted closing the doors, especially regarding Germany and France. Since US and Australia did great harm to Paris in 2021 when they agreed the new AUKUS pact together with UK. Through this agenda-setting process, Washington, D.C. is going to harm another democracy like Tunisia, because Tunisia depends on cheap importation of wheat, and the sanctions might still worsen the tight supply situation and stabilize the Arabic nation. In fact, the U.S. agenda in Eastern Europe follows 20 years of interventions in Middle East and Southern Mediterranean. Now they seem to close this historical NATO war cycle. Remember Kosovo 99, where NATO has set a dangerous precedent in international law, and those who approve this secession cannot denounce Russian actions in the Donbas.
Welcome to our Info News section, where we cover other economic news from around the world. Even though much of the world has been focused on the Russian operations against Ukraine, there has been other major news, like this one. Biden's real challenge is not Russia or China, but poverty in America. This entry said the average American continues to struggle against encroaching poverty, inflation, and lack of future prospects. Moving on, all those promises of tax reforms by the EU, all the news on tax havens, and yet this piece of news shows EU is not serious about it. EU countries fall short of their promises to stop tax havens. It said European ministers updated the EU's list of tax havens. The update added no countries to the blacklist and 10 countries to the gray list. Moving on, a cooperation between France and